It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the AIDS epidemic could be over by 2030, according to United Nations officials. We'll check out the efforts against AIDS here in Wisconsin and around the world.
First, as the 2016 presidential race gets underway, some within the Republican Party are trying to focus more attention on attracting voters in big cities, typically Democratic Party strongholds. Central Time producer Galen Druk is with us to tell us more.
Hey, Veronica. So cities have become increasingly Democratic since the 80s, and in recent elections, they've turned out Democratic voters like never before.
What do those numbers look like?
If you look at local-level politics, the country's 30 most populous cities, only 5 have Republican mayors. And then if you look at the last national election, Obama took all but 3 of those cities. Even big cities in solidly red states like Texas or Alabama and Louisiana all went blue.
And does Wisconsin fit that same pattern?
Okay, so Wisconsin is actually one of the best examples of the rural-urban political divide in the country. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Milwaukee area has grown more politically segregated with almost every election since the Nixon administration. In the 2012 election, President Obama got 67% of the vote in Milwaukee County and just 32% of the vote in the surrounding counties. That makes for the biggest gap between urban and suburban counties in any top 50 metro area other than New Orleans.
So with that backdrop, what are Republicans looking to do to get more votes for the GOP in big cities and urban areas?
Well, I recently spoke to Washington, D.C. Republican National Committee woman Jill Homan. She heads an organization called City GOP that's trying to turn cities red. And actually, the party has done it before. Cities like Philadelphia and Chicago used to have solid Republican operations. I asked her how cities came to be Democratic strongholds in the first place.
A lot of folks don't realize as recently as 1999, if you took the top 12 largest cities, 6 of them, half of them, were led by Republican mayors and the other half by Democrat. And what's happened over time is that the party, Republican Party in cities has unfortunately reduced in number, thereby creating a void in a lot of city Republican parties, but I also see that as being an opportunity to create some small inroads which potentially could have statewide implications.
So what's at stake here if Republicans can't gain ground in American cities?
Well, I'm actually more optimistic than the can't gain ground because I think a small change in a city, meaning picking up a few votes here and there, has both statewide and national implications. And let me just give you an example. When you take, say, the state of Illinois and you look at Cook County, Bruce Rauner, who won, did better than his predecessor candidate 4 years ago, and he did better in Cook County. And so a marginal improvement in Cook County is a great predictor of what happens in the state of Illinois for statewide races.
Has there been concern expressed within the party about this trend? I mean, so if you look at 2012, for example, I mean, the only major cities that went to Republicans were Phoenix, Oklahoma City, Fort Worth, and Salt Lake City, while many large cities in solidly red states went to Obama. And I mean, especially probably concerning would be this in swing states like Florida and Ohio. So is there any concern within the party about that trend?
Let me just first kind of build on what you're talking about in terms of trend. American University has a program that looks at this data and typologies of how to kind of classify the United States, if you will, by demographics. And big cities constitute about 73 million people. So a subset of those people are the voters, and they voted for Obama by over 30 points. What's happened is this conversation about cities is not just limited to the city border, and so you have the core suburbs around the cities have now urbanized to a point that they're behaving like the city, and so those total about 66 million people, and a subset of those voted for Obama by more than 16 points. So taken together, that's 140 million people, of which a percentage votes, and that's 44% of the population. And let's say they vote at the same rate. So you have potentially 44% of the electorate voting for Obama by more than 15 points. And therein lies the issue. But to your point, one of the things, amongst the many things that the National Party is doing is working on first identifying voters, likely voters, and also doing a lot of voter registration efforts, but also a huge, huge effort around engagement. So there are several different divisions within the Republican National Committee that are focused. They wake up every day thinking about how can they engage with African-American, Hispanic, Asian Pacific Islander voters, residents of these cities, because what we've found in terms of a model of running elections where we'll have, you know, say someone from Washington, D.C. parachute into Wisconsin to try to get out the vote in the last 3 months of elections, you know, that model we've found is flawed. And what we've implemented and what the RNC has implemented and the Wisconsin GOP and state parties is a long-term approach looking at engagement, looking at building relationships in cities, in with folks in communities of color so that we have these longer-term relationships and are able to start to make inroads. Because I think it's not just about the campaign and the tactics, which is really interesting and fun to talk about, but I think we also bring policies to bear, and I think we have the best policies to help uplift communities, especially those who are, you know, either low income or communities that are changing. A lot of these cities are rapidly changing, and we think we bring some great policies to bear on that.
Is there something inherently liberal about, I know you'll disagree with this, but I think that some might suggest that there's something inherently liberal about living in a modern city. For example, from a fiscal point of view, you know, every day you are confronted with a reliance on strong government services, ranging from transportation or trash to police. Then on a social level, you're exposed to all different kinds of people and behaviors. Meanwhile, maybe in more rural areas, you can rely more on yourself, drive yourself around, run into fewer people, you know, it's less dense. I mean, is there anything to that idea?
Well, I think that's a question of really causation or correlation or whether there's any pattern here. And I think what I would just say from what I observed is while I agree with you, I think there are people are engaged with government perhaps a little bit more. I also think, you know, the idea of individual rights, you know, I agree with individual rights, but, you know, I live in a townhouse, and where my right begins and your right, my right ends and your right begins, you know, we're kind of a little closer together in a city. And so there's kind of this opting in of people who decide to live in a city in a condo and, you know, in a packed community, that there's a lot more interaction and the city has to, I think, deal perhaps at a higher level of government services. But I think fundamentally the Republican Party is not opposed to that. I think it's not that the Republican Party is opposed to government. Rather, it's the Republican Party favors smart government and that the government is there to work for the people and not the other way around. And so that's why I think we have fantastic programs that we're in favor of and policies such as school choice, which really gives parents the ability to pick the right school for their child and other such programs. And that's when I do a lot of grassroots work, regardless of what party folks are in. Those are the concerns that I'm hearing is, you know, the quality of education for their child and also, their job and whether they have a job or not, or getting to their job is oftentimes a problem.
And from a social perspective, cities have long been perceived as more inviting for people from outside of mainstream American life, like immigrants or gay people. So what do you think the Republican Party has to offer cities when it comes to those kinds of social issues?
Well, I think that what I believe, and a lot of my colleagues in the party believe in, is the big tent Republican Party. And I have friends who represent areas that are much, much more, you know, rural. And, you know, and D.C. happens to be the only city that's a member to the RNC. And so we have a special kind of status as being a city, but also having representatives to the RNC. And I joke a little bit with my friends from rural area where, you know, you might be on one side of the tent and I might be on the other side of the tent, but in order to be a successful national party, there needs to be room for both of us. And I appreciate what my friends in rural areas are trying to do because their policy issues, say, around agriculture and sustainable farming or what have you, are not the top concerns at all when I talk with residents who are struggling to find a job. But at the same time, I think our party, being a party that strongly views in individual responsibility and also about empowering people and getting government out of the way so people can succeed, I think all of that fundamentally creates a party where there's enough room for all of us.
Do you think that in approaching cities as new places to spend more time campaigning, that Republicans in some ways come from a place where they've been perceived as almost having animosity towards those cities? Here's an example from Wisconsin. So Governor Walker, in part, campaigned in 2010 on killing a high-speed railroad between Madison and Milwaukee that would ultimately connect the upper Midwest from Minnesota to Chicago. And so in doing that, he played on themes of the sort of urban-rural divide, sort of pitting the two against each other, you know, saying that, you know, it would spend state money on city things that don't affect other Wisconsinites. Do you think that Republicans should shift away from that kind of rhetoric or even sort of presenting it as a dichotomy?
Well, I think my comments are going to be at a higher level than that specific issue. But I've been asked this question about, say, other governors who've changed plans that may have been implemented by past administrations. And I think there's a fundamental nature for Republicans to want to be great financial stewards to the resources of the taxpayer. And so what I've seen in the D.C. area is just a wanting to understand how these oftentimes public-private partnerships or how these massive transit programs are being implemented. And we've written on it at City GOP about the implementation of massive transit programs when they're led by Republican administrations and contrasting that with major programs by several Democratic administrations. And you know, you can think through in D.C. we have a trolley that is supposed to connect parts of the city, and it's been many, many years and tens of millions of dollars and more that's been spent, and we have yet to have a trolley being implemented. And so I think broadly from a policy standpoint, we need good transportation options. And when I say transportation, I mean all of the above, rail, bus, and here we have bike share, car share, because ultimately, you know, you need to connect people.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you for your time.
That was producer Galen Druk speaking with Jill Homan, Republican National Committee Woman for Washington, D.C., and founder of City GOP. As the 2016 presidential race kicks off, City GOP is trying to attract more Republican voters in the country's big cities. Earlier this month, the United Nations made a big announcement about AIDS treatment and prevention. A goal to provide treatment for 15 million people by the end of this year has been met 9 months ahead of schedule. And with continued progress, the UN said the world could see an end to the AIDS epidemic by the year 2030.
Bill Keaton joins us now for a look at the effort against HIV and AIDS here in Wisconsin and around the world. He's Vice President for Government and Public Relations at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, this idea, ending the global AIDS epidemic by 2030, do we have cause for that kind of optimism?
I think we do have cause for optimism. I'm not sure that 2030 is going to be the magic number, but I do think that the plan that the United Nations is laying out, and given experience that we've seen in smaller settings, if you will, I think there is great reason to be optimistic.
Now, how widespread is HIV/AIDS nowadays here in Wisconsin?
Well, here in Wisconsin, we have about 8,000 people living with HIV, and we're seeing about 250 new cases of HIV here in the state per year. That's down from where we were historically in terms of new infections, but given that people are living longer, healthier lives with HIV, basically every year in the state, the number of people living with HIV continues to grow.
So new cases are down, but the cumulative impact is there are more people living with AIDS now.
Correct. And what we know is that with access to good health care and medications, and by addressing a whole host of other what we call disparities, socioeconomic disparities that tend to lend themselves to disease progression in people living with HIV, by addressing all of those things, we can help people live a really long, healthy life with HIV today.
In some ways, that's really amazing when you look back at the origins of the disease in the 80s and 90s and what a plague, a destructive plague it was.
Right. I mean, we were experiencing rapid disease progression and death amongst most people who were infected within 18 months to a couple of years. Today, we know that if we identify someone with HIV early on in the disease, when the infection is still relatively new, the doctors in our clinic tell them that they're going to live probably a normal lifespan. The challenge with that, however, is that they do need to take their medications every day. The medications are still very expensive. And they do come with some side effects as well. So it's not something that anyone should take lightly or think is an easy situation to live with it.
I wanted to ask, with grounds for optimism, better long-term prognosis, do you see a kind of complacency setting in that could be dangerous?
I think we are starting to see some complacency, and actually we've probably been seeing it for quite some time. And that's, you know, it's a double-edged sword. It is reflective of the fact that people can live a long, healthy life with HIV. But unfortunately, what we're also still seeing is that there's still stigma associated with this disease, that there is still a lot of people who don't fully understand how HIV is transmitted. And unfortunately, I think approach HIV with a laissez-faire attitude, which is to say, I can get in, I can just take a pill, and I'll be healthy. The truth of the matter is that, if a patient misses more than one treatment in terms of their daily regimens in a two-week period, we do start to see the disease start to develop resistance to the treatment that they're on, which may mean they need to go to an older line of medications to treat their disease. And there's a whole host of other long-term effects of HIV that we're still just beginning to learn about. Things like neurocognitive impairment that's associated with HIV disease. We're seeing in some of our patients maybe 10 or 15 years before one might expect to see things like dementia and other sorts of neurocognitive impairment happening amongst our patients at an earlier age. So there are still a lot of things to learn about HIV, and I think the complacency is something that we all need to be aware of.
I want to get into the priorities now in Wisconsin. Where are the priorities when it comes to prevention and outreach here in the state?
Sure. I think the priorities at this point in prevention are really targeting those groups who are most at risk for HIV infection. And we do a really good job in this state of tracking the epidemic and following the trends. What we know is that males are much more likely to become HIV positive than females. And amongst that group, it's primarily men who are having sex with other men or gay men who we know are being disproportionately impacted. We also know that injection drug users are is significantly at risk for HIV. And this is something that's really alarming given the resurgence of the heroin epidemic in our state. A lot of folks who are unfortunately becoming addicted to heroin are doing so and using it intravenously, and that's a pretty significant risk factor for HIV as well. So we really target, as an agency and I think as a state, those two populations or groups of individuals with a lot of our prevention activities.
And as we wrap up, how is Wisconsin doing when it comes to access to treatment for people who do have HIV and AIDS?
I'm really proud to say that if you look at all of the states across the country, Wisconsin has the second lowest death rate associated with HIV in the nation. What that tells us is that people who get HIV here in Wisconsin are getting good access to care and treatment, whether it's at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin through our medical system or other groups such as UW Hospital and Clinics and other great providers of health care. We're actually doing, I'm really proud to say, a great job of helping to manage the epidemic in the state of Wisconsin, which is actually one of the best sorts of prevention strategies as well. We know that people who are managing their HIV well are less physiologically able to transmit HIV to somebody else. It's a great prevention strategy.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. Have a great day.
That was Bill Keaton, Vice President of Government and Public Relations at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, responding to the UN announcement this month that the AIDS epidemic could be ended by 2030. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll take a look at Governor Walker's recent comments about how he'd change the Environmental Protection Agency if he were elected president.
First, today the Assembly voted to approve the deal providing $250 million in public subsidies to fund a new Milwaukee Bucks arena. The measure passed in the state Senate a few weeks ago. Now it heads to Governor Walker's desk. He has said he supports the idea of some public funding for a new arena in the past.
Jason Stein joins us now to talk about the deal. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back.
Thanks, Veronica. Good to be here.
Well, the State Assembly met today to debate the Bucks Arena bill before it passed. And before they went into session, Republicans announced that they thought they had enough votes to pass that measure. What was the debate like?
Well, it was really sort of anticlimactic because you've had this proposal that had really pretty determined opposition and a really tough road to get to today. And then you had a debate. It lasted about an hour. There were none of the opponents actually spoke on the floor. There was just very little drama today compared to, you know, the long road to this vote.
What do you make of that? Is it just a testament to having a long time to hammer out details?
Several things. I mean, I think in part it came out of the state Senate, which was the biggest hurdle with a strong bipartisan vote, 21, I believe. Yeah, 21 to 10. So that, I think, showed supporters and opponents that the bill could pass the Assembly, and that's what it did. I think to a certain extent the changes to the bill in the Senate dampened criticism. I mean, they certainly did not eliminate it by any stretch, but did somewhat mitigate concerns of critics.
And in the Assembly, the arena plan passed, 52 to 34 are the numbers I've got. Was that expected?
Correct. Correct. And you have to remember, too, normally there are 99 members in the Assembly, but there were only 89 today. And, for some technical reasons, that was and the absences, that vote was far above what it needed to be, or at least was, you know, a healthy margin over where it needed to be.
Now, a few weeks, maybe a couple weeks before we got to this point where we are today, we spoke with some Democratic lawmakers on this program who said that the Republicans were reaching out to them to try to build compromise and support for this Bucks deal. Did that come into play?
Well, they certainly did draw some Democrats on board for the measure. Today, you had 17 Democrats among the 52 lawmakers that voted for the proposal. Again, it was generally cooked by the time Democratic lawmakers got involved, but they did have some input, and obviously you know, the bargain that everyone started out with, a few weeks ago, was struck between the team, the governor, Republican lawmakers, and Democratic leaders in Milwaukee, Mayor Tom Barrett and County Executive Chris Abele. So you did have some Democratic participation through the process.
We're talking with Jason Stein right now, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the Milwaukee Bucks arena deal, which passed the state assembly today, goes next to Governor Scott Walker for signing. And Jason, let's hear about the bill itself, or the deal itself. What's in it?
Sure. It's a quarter of $1 billion, $250 million of public financing that will pay for half of the overall arena. It includes a contribution from state taxpayers, from the city of Milwaukee, from Milwaukee County, as well as an entertainment district in the Milwaukee area that controls some ticket surcharge fees on Bucks games, as well as some taxes on, you know, lodging, food, rental cars, entertainment related and travel related stuff like that.
And now, before they approved the bill, the senators added a 12-page amendment. What did they change from that original plan? Do we know?
Sure, it was a number of things. There were a lot of concerns on the part of Democrats and even some Republicans that the previous version of the bill had relied on getting money from Milwaukee County debtors. So in other words, there's a certain amount of money that's owed to Milwaukee County. The plan was going to transfer those debts to the state of Wisconsin, which has more tools to collect on the debts, and that would have generated revenue to sort of cover Milwaukee County's share of this. The concern was that you would, in some sense, be building this arena for millionaire players and billionaire team owners on the backs of people who didn't have the money to pay their bills. You know, again, that's not my statement, but that was the concern of many critics. And so that part of the proposal was dropped from the bill. Milwaukee County officials can still choose to do that, but the proposal no longer mandates that.
And there's a change to the surcharge on tickets.
That's right. So right now, I believe it's $2 for all tickets that are more than $12 face value, and $1.50 for all tickets that are less than $12. Going forward, it'll be just $2, no matter how much your ticket costs.
And that adds up a surprising amount, according to projections.
Right. Well, it certainly brings in more money. For critics, that was helpful in the sense that it was putting a little more money for the arena, assigning that to actually people that are going to the games. So a user fee, if you will, instead of a tax.
Now, going back to the split among taxpayers there, how is that $250 million being split among different taxpaying groups?
Yeah, it's roughly $50 million for all concerned. And, Veronica, you'll forgive me if I don't have every one of those figures at my fingertips. But
sure.
But roughly $50 million for city, state, and county, and then a little bit more for the entertainment district. And when you include over 20 years the interest, that $250 million becomes $400 million in total.
Now, you mentioned the entertainment district. Now, it's not just the Bucks Arena. We're talking about a whole new district, a whole new complex of downtown Milwaukee attractions. Can you give us a picture, Jason, of what that might be?
Right. So, currently, the Bucks play at the Bradley Center. Certain other sports teams play there. You know, going forward at the new arena, you know, you will likely have Marquette's basketball team playing at the new arena as well as the Bucks, perhaps some other sports will happen there. And then what under this proposal, you will have more of Milwaukee entertainment entities and, you know, performing arts, the arts, go under the umbrella of this super board, which will have, again, the power for some time to continue to collect taxes on lodging, food, rental cars that would have otherwise been phased out.
So there's the entity in charge of this whole downtown complex, it's a board, it's not a single person.
Correct. And so there would be representatives from the governor, from the Senate and Assembly, to a certain extent by groups affected by these taxes that I told you about, groups that have skin in the game, so to speak, because of what they or their customers are paying, in addition to help fund amenities like the Bucks Arena. Obviously, the arena, we think of it first and foremost as a place where an NBA team is going to play, but obviously it would be available for all kinds of other concerts and events that might need a large indoor space to do their show.
Now, along the way, opponents of this bill have said it's helping the already wealthy owners of the Bucks, and that it doesn't make sense to spend so much money on a new arena when the budget for the state of Wisconsin, the new budget, has called for cuts from other areas like education and infrastructure. Did that debate come up? Was there a defining argument from proponents about why the deal should go through today?
Yes. I mean, that argument has been part of this from the get-go. And, you know, obviously part of the difficulties that this proposal had was that it was coming amid a difficult state budget. It wasn't coming amid a budget where there was money for everything and everybody. What it came down to is supporters said, look, the state for its share of this would only need to kick in about $3.5 million a year, and the state is already getting about $6 million a year in income taxes associated with the Bucks, and that number would go up over time. So supporters said, look, it's an easy call to do it. Opponents said, well, you know, not so fast. Not all of the income tax money that are associated with the Bucks would necessarily leave the state if the team left. And then, you know, they also pointed out that we can, as a public, as a state, city, and county, we can invest that money in lots of different things, and all of them would have a return for the public if they were done right, whether that's a new road, a new teacher in a classroom, you know, lower taxes for taxpayers. All those things have a potential return as well.
So this deal has now passed the Senate, the Assembly. The next step is the desk of Governor Scott Walker. Is it a sure thing that he's going to be signing this swiftly?
He says it is. And he said today, while he was gobbling up Philadelphia cheesesteaks as part of his presidential campaign, he said that he would be signing the proposal. He will have the ability to use his very powerful partial veto pen on this bill, but he's given no indication so far that he's going to do that. I mean, so far, what he's talked about is simply signing it and praising the legislation.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Jason Stein, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was talking about the Milwaukee Bucks arena deal, which just passed the state assembly today. The bill now goes to Governor Scott Walker's desk for signing.
And we want to hear from you on this issue now. Do you think the Bucks arena deal will be a good thing for Milwaukee and the region as it stands? How would you change the deal if you could have done so? Is it worth some public funding to keep the Bucks in Milwaukee? And Whether you like the deal or not, will you check out the arena, maybe catch a game there? Call in now with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're taking your calls right now on the Bucks arena deal at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the plan to build a new arena in Milwaukee? Do you think this is going to be good for the city, keep the downtown hopping? How do you think the plan should have been different if you're not a fan of it? What do you like about it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We go to our first caller now. We've got Mark with us in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Hi. This is about the dumbest thing that we could have done, because the idea that money itself is something that we have to borrow from outside of ourselves instead of created ourselves is about as stupid as it could get. If we had a State Bank of Wisconsin like they have the State Bank of North Dakota, the State Bank could fund this. And then all the revenues that come back, all the repayment, all the interest would go straight back into the state budget. As it stands, every bit of borrowed money, whether it's for this or for highways and all of that, all of the interest is actually a drain straight out of the state, straight out of our economy.
Mark, thank you for your thoughts. Appreciate you calling in and giving us your take on this and an alternate fiscal view you think would have been more fruitful here. Melissa is next, joins us from Menominee Falls. Melissa, hi.
Hi. I love the Brewers and I love the Bucks, and I do think that they really help keep the downtown area thriving, but I think the way that we're paying for this is so crazy. We're in so much debt already, and these owners, they have millions of dollars, and they're going to reap the rewards of the Bucks and downtown, well, a little bit, but what about all the people outside of downtown that are paying for it? They're not going to see the cash for it. Just the owners are going to. Why do the owners need our help paying for it? That I'm not sure I understand.
All right, Melissa, appreciate your thoughts there. Melissa loves the Bucks, loves the Brewers, but she's not 100% behind this arena deal, thinks it maybe could have been funded a little bit more by the owners. Thanks. Interesting perspective there. Going next to Jane. Jane joining us from Madison. Hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I don't want state money used for it, because I feel that it's the businesses in Milwaukee are the ones that will benefit if there is any benefit. I think that the owners of the Brewers are the ones that will get the most benefit, and I think they're the ones that should put in most, if not all, of the money.
What do you think about the possibility of a revitalized downtown Milwaukee?
I think that would be a great idea. Maybe more people would be willing to shop there, but I'm not the poorest person. I'm not certainly not rich. And yet I have never gone to a Brewers game. I've never gone to a professional basketball game. And I'm in my late 70s. I'm sure there are many, many, many other people that have not gone to professional games. And I don't think they should have to pay for their taxes for these arenas and stadiums.
All right, Jane, appreciate your call and appreciate your thoughts on this as well. Thank you so much for all your calls. And remember, you can keep the conversation going about the Bucks Arena deal on the Central Time Facebook page. Looks like maybe we have time for one more call. Let's go to Craig in Kenosha. Craig, hello.
Hello.
Hi there. What do you think?
I think that with all the money that our government has taken away from education, maybe that $250 million is better spent on having an educated population than on a sports arena.
So you'd like to see that money allocated somewhere else, Craig?
I would like to see us not throwing our tax money away on private interest.
Will it keep you away from the arena?
It definitely will keep me away from the arena. I have no interest in that.
Okay, appreciate your thought, Craig. Thank you so much for calling. And again, you've got your thoughts, so keep them going over on the Central Time Facebook page. You can find us by searching Central Time on WPR.